Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Liz Moore. Liz has been here before to discuss her second book, Heft, after which she did a reading and signing at our store, Wellington Square Bookshop, and she'll be appearing there again to read and sign from her latest work, and the one we'll be discussing today, The Unseen World, published in July by Norton. She'll be at the store on Friday, October 28th at 7 o'clock. Liz's first novel was The Words of Every Song way back in 2007, and then Heft, which we talked about, in 2012. And now, but close to clockwork, we have The Unseen World. So Liz received her MFA in fiction from Hunter and lives in Philly and is an assistant professor of writing at Holy Family University. Her work has appeared in Tin House, The New York Times, and Narrative, and she spent most of 2014 and 2015 in Rome, which must have been fun, writing this book. So, which first of all has this great cover and three of the best epigraphs ever, which would be enough for me right there. So, The Unseen World, seen kind of through the eyes of Ada, the precocious and painfully shy at times protagonist, is a work of mystery, science, and the thought of an intelligence, not ours, which may reach beyond what we now consider the limit of a computer's abilities. In other words, AI, a computer that passes the Turing test. Ada's father is an enigma, a riddle which unravels slowly but deftly. He's at once a didactic teacher, at least in the beginning, the be-all and end-all of Ada's young life. She's 12 when the story begins. Although we travel from the 20s to the almost present, with various stops along the way. Our second and most unusual protagonist, perhaps our most important, is Elixir, a constantly evolving computer intelligence which in many ways drives the plot and the conclusion of The Unseen World, which, by the way, is much more than just a title. David, Ava's dad, is winding down because of Alzheimer's, while Elixir is winding up and Ada is growing up. And something that David can no longer articulate is passed from him to Ada and others, which is a key to another story, an unseen story, and one which answers lots of questions, but in so doing, especially for the reader, asks another more profound one. With that, welcome, Liz, and thank you so much for being here and coming to see us again.
Thank you, Sam. I'm really delighted to be talking to you again.
So, you know how I am, so before I go off on my usual rant, tell us a little bit about the book, because if I don't say it now, I'll never say it.
Well, you did a really great job of summarizing the book, so I guess I don't have much to add to the summary aside from, you know, the fact that it's different than any other book that I've written, and it was more challenging in certain ways, and I'm glad that I'm done with the writing of it, and I'm really nervous and curious about the way it will be perceived now that it's out in the real world.
Oh, the manager of my bookstore, Donna, who you met before, and I just said, we just think it's going to, you know, it's definitely going to be a big book, in our opinion. And we're usually right.
That would be nice. That would be very nice.
It was a great book.
Thank you.
So the epigraphs, because sometimes I feel, I think as I told you last time, they kind of frame the book. The first is from the Manchester University computer, which was developed by Alan Turing in 1948, with the awkward love letter that's the epigraph being penned in 1951. Did something... Well, you talked a little bit about Turing, but did something start you with this semi-articulate love letter?
Yes. So Turing is really... research about Turing is really what sparked the idea for the book. And as I mentioned, originally Turing was a more central part of or figure in the book. But because so many projects came out at the same time that included Turing, I sort of began to lose interest in him artistically, which I think happens anytime you feel like something's being overdone a little bit. So I reduced his real role in the book, but I kept a lot of the philosophy that he had espoused about when we can truly call machines intelligent. And what really charmed me about about Alan Turing was his kind of fondness, sort of an emotional fondness for machines, and the fact that he and his colleagues had designed this. They could have done anything to demonstrate the Manchester University computer's strength and power, and instead they chose to design a program that would generate love letters, which I thought was just really touching and kind of cute in a weird way. And so I also, that epigraph reflects the intelligence of Elixir, who's the program that's kind of at the center of the novel too.
Well, it's funny because you said you misspoke and said David, but David's kind of like, maybe he was in there in the beginning and you took him out, but he's kind of like a flawed Alan Turing. But then again, going to the second epigraph, Alan Turing is kind of a flawed Alan Turing.
Right. And yes, David's definitely a Turing-esque figure. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No. What I was going to say, I wanted to talk about the second epigraph, which kind of also frames the book in a way, because it's the letter that Alan writes to his friend saying, oh no, what I thought was going to happen happened, and I can tell you about it later, but it's really going to be a mess, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So how'd you go from the letter that Alan Turing essentially created to the point where he's writing a letter in which he's basically saying, well, after that pretty much kind of ended his life?
Well, the line that I love most in that particular passage, that letter, is, I'll emerge from it all a different man, but quite who I can't say, which gave me chills when I read it, because it seems to me to reflect the central mystery of the book so well also. I mean, quite literally, they won't give anything about the book away to say that David has been dishonest about his past, and his daughter has to figure out who he really is. So the fact that Turing had this, you know, it's a coincidence of language, but it really stood out to me for that reason, the idea of emerging from a big mess a different man, literally in David's case, is it just seemed to fit with the book so well. It was almost like a message from the past.
Yeah, especially since he was hiding something similar that Alan Turing was hiding, and and then the other descent that he had from cognition to not cognition.
Yeah, so, absolutely. So we don't have to delve too deeply into this.
Sorry.
I also came across this while I was doing my research. There's a whole trove of people who have conspiracy theories about Alan Turing, about how he, either that he was murdered or that he like faked his own death and all this stuff. And it was like a lot of that stuff I found, if not entirely believable necessarily, really inspiring creatively.
It sounds like if all this stuff hadn't been spinning around about Alan Turing while you were writing the book, if no one had ever written a book about him, this would have been a novel about him. Maybe I'm wrong.
Possibly, yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, ever since I was a kid, I was really fascinated by Turing. I learned about the Turing test as a kid because my mother's a linguist, and she was really fascinated by the Turing test. And I read his essay on computing machinery and intelligence, I read as a child, and just thought it was fascinating. And so Turing has always been an important figure in my life. And so in thinking about writing a book that included a lot of his ideas, I just didn't anticipate that everyone else would have the same idea at the same time.
Yeah, I know. It's so funny because I did the same thing, and I kept...
Yeah.
The hardest thing to visualize was a Turing machine, which would have to be the size of the observable universe. You know,
right.
you could do one, and then that actually goes towards your book too in a way, which I won't give away.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it really does. And then the third epigraph is Eddington's.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, why did you throw that in? But it really is kind of like one of those statements that's, like I said, a dorm room conversation. At the end of everything, we really don't know what the hell is going on.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. There's this concept of an unseen world that might lie just beyond what we understand to be reality, which also is kind of what the book is about.
And the only way we get around it is by pretending that it's not there.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So you've heard that story about, I'm sure you have, that story about Eddington, like the guy who came up to him and said, there's only three people alive that understand Einstein's theory of relativity. And Eddington goes, who's the other one?
No, I actually hadn't heard that. And I should confess that I don't know as much about Eddington as I do about Turing and the other figures in the book. I first got interested in Eddington because Turing was interested in Eddington. And I read Andrew Hodges' biography of Alan Turing, and Eddington was mentioned in it as somebody that Turing was interested in. So then I read his book, Science and the Unseen World, but that's as far as I got into understanding Eddington. He has some weird stuff about, I mean, it sounds like you know more about him than I do, but the balance that he struck between like religion and science was also kind of weird to me and interesting, and also the fact that Turing liked him, even though, I don't know, Turing's relationship with religion was strange. And anyway, that's a great story about him.
It is. It's because he's that kind of person, and just the fact that he sailed, you know, half the world to verify that Einstein's theory that light bends during an eclipse is just amazing. And it had to be sunny out. That's the thing that always gets to me. What if it hadn't have been sunny? And then, funny. I don't know what you did. It's like, and I'll say this later on too, it's like, during this book, it seems like you woke up like I do. And when I wake up, I might go downstairs and get a peanut butter sandwich. But instead, you wake up and write down Grossman's name, Snell's name, and Ibn Sal's. I mean, because like, where the heck did it come from, and why is it on the first couple of pages?
I think I just wanted to illustrate what a typical interaction might be between David and Ada, and I just happened to be writing about light, and so I just wanted to, you know, I sort of just, every part of this book required research. I didn't know off the top of my head who described refraction. You know what I mean? So I was writing a passage about a light in the kitchen, and that's how the book opens. And then I just thought, well, what would David have to say about this light? And what he would have to say would be, he'd be quizzing his daughter about the science behind the light, it's rather than just observing the light as a beautiful thing.
It's almost like the Glass family and...
in Franny and Zoe.
Yeah, like Seymour. Yep. It's almost like that.
Yep, there's definitely... I think that book is actually name-checked in mine, too.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
And then, you know, okay, then I go, okay, here's these three scientists. Now I got to look them up. I had to look at their formulas and see the refraction, all that. Okay, well, now I can start reading the novel again. So the next page is Hegelian dialectic.
Right.
And I got to go, I know I remember that from somewhere. So what is it exactly? So... I'm starting to I'm going, Liz, all right, you know, let's just get...
let's get the plot going. Yeah, I'm sure other people will have that reaction.
No, I mean, it was in a good way. I mean, when you can get the reader off of his chair, well, in my case, all I had to do was press the word, but just go to Google or Wikipedia, which saves my life. But, and then like the riddle of the two paths, was that something that's been in your mind since you were a kid? Is it something you knew the answer to already?
That is another riddle that was often told in my family. I don't know why, but it was. And I remember, my mother refusing to tell me the answer to it. And this was before, obviously, you could just Google the answer to riddles. So she would tell me that riddle at intervals in my childhood until I finally figured out the answer to it. So it became a really maddening thing for me. And it's a famous riddle. I just didn't have access. I didn't know where to look up the answer to that riddle. And so it was, I feel like she was almost like diabolically measuring my intelligence, brain growth every year or every 6 months by, you know, reminding me of the riddle and seeing if I can figure out the answer to it yet.
And that's why it's so poignant when, you know, David says what he says, because it'll be like your mother saying, you know what I mean? It's just...
Yeah.
And I've seen that happen to people, and
me too.
Yeah, it's like it's tragic, but you really portray it well, because everyone just kind of assumes it didn't happen, but then they all have to get up and kind of like, hey, it's time to leave, you know? It's time to leave the party.
Right. Yeah, it definitely ends the party when you can't remember the punchline to the riddle or the solution to the riddle.
And then the other thing about like getting up in the middle of the night, when you came up with your music, like the Clancy Brothers and stuff, was there a reason why you came up with, you know, this esoteric blend of country and other music? And yeah, especially given your music and your new album is really, really good too, by the way.
I don't play music much anymore. Unfortunately, my first book was, of course, about music, and I released an album then, but I haven't really played in a long time, unfortunately. I'm sort of more focused on writing these days.
Yeah, I guess when
And I miss it, but I don't know. I feel like I've chosen writing over music.
Yes.
But to answer your question, you asked about the Clancy Brothers, like why did I include them?
Yeah.
It felt right for an Irish American family in Boston in the 80s, I guess, to like the Clancy Brothers. There's another one of the central figures in the book is David's colleague Liston, who grows up very working class in Dorchester and happens to be have a really good scientific mind. So she gets her PhD and goes to work in the lab that David runs and ends up taking in Ada when David's mind begins to fail. So she likes the Clancy Brothers because it's what Irish Americans in Dorchester might have liked growing up in the 50s and 60s. And yeah, that's sort of where that came from.
There's a lot of references that kind of push and pull you because they're real things. And it's like, even at the end when you, and I said, oh, Liz, you're doing it again, Liz. When you gave the name of Afra Behn, her novel, which, you know, who knew? I didn't know she was like this groundbreaking person that was a spy and also was just all the things she did. And then Lady Lovelace, who Ada was named after, I didn't realize that she was involved in Charles Babbage's Difference Engine. Did you ever read that book, The Difference Engines, by William Gibson and Bruce Sterling?
No, I didn't.
It's like the first steampunk novel.
Well, William Gibson is Neuromancer, right?
Right.
Which is also a book that I haven't read and I should read after having written
this
book, because it was a pioneering book in terms of the themes that it includes I also include in my book.
Yeah, it kind of changed my life. And it was really funny because William Gibson never looked at a computer prior to writing that book. He knew
That's
nothing
crazy.
About it. I know.
Yeah. I tried to avoid things like that while I was writing the book, but now that I'm done, I feel like I have to read them all. So maybe I'll start there.
Yeah. Neuromancer is a great place to start, definitely.
Yeah.
But then you got me on one, which is Tristan Ford. There is no Tristan Ford.
No. I think that, so because the book moves into the future, I had to invent the name of a future novelist. That was my invented name.
That drove me crazy. I came up with some kind of soccer star that was close.
Oh, that's funny. I didn't ever think to Google it. I probably should have.
Well, Google says, are you sure you want to do this? You know, it's like...
You're right.
You want to change it to something else?
Right.
With Liston, you know, because the book goes off in several different directions, and one of them is like with Liston and her children, there's this kind of intertwinement of two different kind of love stories. Did that evolve organically as you went along, or did it like spring full blown like Athena from Zeus's head, or how did it come about? Because it's a very interesting set of relationships.
So initially, Ada has a crush on Liston's oldest son, William, who is a very kind of stereotypical, popular in school, handsome, all that stuff, and he's older than she is. It was early on in the book, the fact that she has this crush on him is clear early on in the book while she's still living with David, and she's kind of spying on William, who's her neighbor. And I don't know, in terms of, like, technically it represents a problem for her, like a yearning that she has, and I think that can drive a book forward. And later on it becomes clear that it's not, her interest in William is problematic, and there's a different love story that develops for her. And I guess that was just a product of the fact that the book covers so much of her life. It moves forward into her adulthood and into the future. And I guess I had to ask myself who she was most likely to fall in love with of all the characters that existed in the book. And then my question was answered, I guess.
Yeah, and answered very adroitly. And also, not only was the love story essentially consummated, if you will, but also there was a piece of the puzzle that came along with it.
Yeah, that's right. Part of the love interest ends up having sort of the answer to the question, helping her to figure out the answer to the question that she's had for a long time.
Oh, what's the thing, and you can explain it because I can't remember the term, when you have a code and you can't break it because there's a, not passbook, what's it called?
Oh, a one-time pad.
Yeah, what is that? Missing. Explain that to our listeners.
Oh, God, I'll do my best. These are early days of interviews, and this is kind of what I've been dreading about the publication of this book.
It's
being asked to explain the concepts that I, like, so assiduously researched and, like, don't actually have a working understanding of. No, a one-time pad is often functioned as an unbreakable code because it would be a set of letters or numbers, for example, that were so completely random that when combined with the source text, it produces an unbreakable code. So, for example, if you assigned every letter a number value in a source text, like what the thing that you want to encode, and then you combine it with a completely random one-time pad of random letters or numbers, and you either add them or subtract them, there's no machine at this point in history that could break the encoded text without the one-time pad, which is typically when used in, you know, when used by a spy, for example, during the Second World War, would be destroyed immediately. A one-time pad would be delivered with the code and then destroyed immediately. So it would never be used again, which also made it very difficult to crack.
Which is kind of what happened here unknowingly when the one-time pad was essentially somewhere where no one would have expected it to be.
Exactly, yeah. So there's no frequency of like letters and numbers, and there's no machine encoding it, which could be decoded on the other end. It's just completely kind of pulled out of thin air. That's part of the secret of the book.
Yeah, and actually the only way someone could do it would be something like Elixir, who knew somebody so intimately in every detail of their life that they could choose what the one-time pad would be.
Right. You would have to guess the one-time pad, which would be very difficult.
Okay, I'll ask you an easy question now since that was tough. Because you had to pull it all back out. So Ada is painfully shy at first. Does that resonate with you at all? Were you like that at all?
Yeah, as a kid I was very, very painfully shy. Up until a certain age. I think as a teenager I was less shy. But as a young child and through elementary school, I was really incredibly shy. And almost to the point where it was a problem that, you know, needed sorting out professionally, like, you know, teachers would have things to say about it and stuff. And I guess I can still be shy in certain situations where I'm not as, you know, I'm like a lot of writers, I'm more introverted than extroverted in a lot of ways, although I enjoy hanging out socially in certain situations. But yeah, her childhood definitely, I was able to draw from some memories that I had in order to create her. Absolutely.
Going back to science, it's funny because I can remember back when I first started practicing law and we had this thing called a mag card reader. And it was like, it was gigantic. But all it could do basically was remember a salutation and a closing. So it could remember Dear Mr. Blank and yours with whatever. And it was gigantic. And then 5.5 floppies, and then even you bring them up in the book, you know, 3.5 disks, which essentially no longer are needed. And then underneath my 512 Mac, although I have an even earlier one, a 128, I had my first 100 meg hard drive, which cost $400 and weighed 6 pounds. And if someone sent you a 100 meg memory stick now, you would just throw it in the trash, because why would they send me something this small?
Right.
So do you think? Yeah, I know. It is absolutely amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, given the way you described Elixir and the unseen world, do you think it's going to keep going that way, or are you just speculating, or you don't even believe it?
Do you mean?
Do you think?
Do I imagine the things that I describe in the book might actually happen?
Exactly.
No, I can guarantee you that they won't happen as I've described them, because that would be a huge coincidence and a huge stroke of luck. Because the things that I describe are so specific, I can't imagine that they'll come true exactly in that way. Nor did I really mean to imply that they would. I guess part of it is this is my literary imagination more than it is my prediction of the future. I think that in the future, I do imagine, I guess the only prediction that I'll make is that virtual space will come to be seen or come to be useful or come to be used in the way that we use the real world more than it is now. I think as virtual reality becomes more and more authentic seeming to us, we will use it more. I recently tried out Oculus Rift for the first time.
Uh-huh.
I think I expected to be let down by it after inventing this super sophisticated, very advanced idea, like the virtual world in the book. And instead, I was really pleasantly impressed by it and surprised by it. I think they're doing a really good job, and it does feel real in certain ways. Obviously, the graphics aren't impeccable, but you do feel, when you put on the Oculus Rift headset, you do feel physical sensations that you don't expect to feel. One of the things that they're demoing right now is a game called The Climb, where you're a rock climber, and you actually feel your heart racing, as you're climbing this sheer cliff face. And I felt like I was getting hotter, and it was a really interesting experience. And I'm glad that they're getting there. It makes it really fun to play.
It's funny because just this last week and a half or so, even at the bookstore, with the kids playing Pokemon Go,
yeah,
it's just mm-hmm. insane. And that, they call that augmented reality, but
right,
it's just amazing to watch. And there's so many people doing it now.
Yeah.
One of the 16-year-olds who works in the bookstore says it's just a fad. It'll be over in 4 months. But
yeah.
I think it's the beginning of something. I just don't
exactly.
know what.
Exactly. Something else will come along that uses augmented reality in the same way and will maybe replace that, but it's not going to go back to, what it was before.
No, it never does unless...
Yeah.
Unless it does because of some fascistic politicians who might...
Right. Right.
Which is also just as scary. You read The NeverEnding Story, right?
I never read it, no. I saw the movie.
I love that movie. Falcor and The Luck Dragon and all that stuff. Well, The NeverEnding Story, and there's another one called Sophie's World, which is like this history of philosophy, but there's this immersion thing in it.
Uh-huh.
And, in The NeverEnding Story, in the movie, how he's up in the attic,
Yeah.
And he has to call out the name.
Yeah.
Your book reminded me of that. And I don't want to give away anything, but let's see, how can I phrase this so it doesn't screw things up? It's like there's a part of you that says, oh, well, this is it then,
Yeah. Yeah, I do know what you mean. That is interesting.
Because that's what I thought. I said, well, then that's what I've been doing for the past 3 or 4 hours.
It's kind of meta.
That's
great.
I'm not the first to say that, right?
Well, you are. But I should also say Not that many people have read the book yet. No, just that. I mean, it comes out next week, so it's had a pretty limited set of readers. And so, what's great about talking to you now is that everything is new. You know, everything. I'm still kind of figuring out what people will say and think about the book.
Well, then, if we're skirting around the edges of giving away anything. Mm-hmm. In your own mind, when you were writing it, was that something like, did you go back and say, oh, it could be this instead?
I guess. I mean, that's always a thought that is present when I'm writing. You know, the various possibilities that exist for any book and the decisions that you make at various junctures that end up becoming like fact in the, or, you know, end up making it into the final draft of the book. And, I guess it's like a sliding doors thing. You wonder
exactly
what you could have done differently and what the book would have been like. Sure.
Yes, actually, like sliding doors in a couple of different ways.
So
that's funny. It's funny at the beginning. You go, I don't want to talk about Heft anymore. It's like you were very generous when we talked about Heft because you're kind of saying like, okay, I'm letting this go, which you're really not saying with this book yet, but when you let it go, you're letting me, the reader, go off on all these tangents that might or might not be true. It's just what's happening in my head. So is that the way you feel this time? Like, you know, okay, here you are. You guys do what you will with it. You usually have that feeling?
Yeah, I do think, yes. I think that when you finish any book, it's like I have really wrung myself dry. I don't have any more to write, and I don't have any more to add. And
that's interesting.
However people react to it or perceive it is correct in a way. Like, you know, I always tell my creative writing students, you're not going to be there to explain things, like sit on the shoulder of the reader and explain things or argue with the reader in any way. So however your reader perceives your book is correct. That's a correct answer or correct way of perceiving it. I think I'm done and I'm ready to let people read it and react to it however they will.
Well, it's funny because I just interviewed this guy, Arturo Perez Reverte. It was the first time I had to use a translator in an interview. It was interesting.
And
he wrote this book, What We Become. And he is meticulous when he describes in a very Argentinian way, like this guy's in this stateroom of this beautiful cruise ship. And it describes him getting dressed, and he puts his Dunhill lighter in his pocket, and he packs his cigarettes in their cigarette case very nicely. And he puts his watch with its chain on and the little cigar cutter in his suit and his three different handkerchiefs and all this stuff. And I said to him, how can you describe this room and this person and his clothes and everything that's happening? And he goes, I don't do that. You do that. And I thought about it and I realized, well, I'm the one who knows what a Dunhill lighter is.
That's true. Does he mean that you're the one doing the imagining, like the visualizing of it from his description?
Yeah,
that's what he meant?
Yeah, there's that one book, What We See When We Read. So like if you're reading The Fall of the House of Usher, I know there's this tarn in this house, but I don't really see it.
Yeah, that's true.
Whereas with him, you could see it perfectly. And he does it several times, but he's saying it's not him doing it. I am not doing it. He insisted on it.
That's interesting.
I know. I thought about it a lot afterwards because I'm thinking, these things, I know what they are. So once he says the words, it's not him creating the picture.
Right. You are the one conjuring the image from your history or memory or whatever.
Yeah, like I know what Elixir looks like, kind of, but I don't really have a picture of Elixir, but I don't need one. Just the fact that it's capitalized gives me so... You know what? Just the fact that it's capitalized gives me a whole lot to work with, doesn't it?
Yeah. That's great.
It's weird.
Yeah. I used to have this might give stuff away. Well, I'll just say I used to have a visual description of Elixir as a figure in
oh,
the
no.
book, and it was
no.
excised. Don't give it away.
Yeah, don't give it away. I know what it was.
Right.
Yeah, you kind of still left the very dregs of it in there, kind of.
Right. Yeah.
That's pretty good. I know that, right?
Yeah, it is. You're a very attentive reader. You're an avid reader.
All right. Well, with that, that's a great way to end.
Yeah.
Well, so I'm so excited you're coming again, and we'll have a great time. And I can pick you. I'll pick you up again like I did last time. Not me. I mean, sound right.
Right. That we can chat about that. I should tell you that I now have a 7-week old at home, so this is going to be a very different experience for me than it was last time.
Boy or
but,
girl?
Yeah. It's a girl, little girl.
Ada?
Yeah. No, that would be weird though, right?
Yeah.
I've had to avoid using certain names in my fiction that I think I might ever want to actually name a child in the future.
That's a good point.
But thank you so much for having me on again. It was really a delight to talk to you, as always.
Oh, so glad to be talking again with Liz Moore. She's the author of The Unseen World, which is just coming out now as we speak. And it's a great book. And if you read Heft or came to the bookstore when she came to sign it, it was a great book, really great. And about a topic that was about this incredibly obese guy and his life, but it was a topic that wasn't really talked about. And although this one, which is about computational engines and the ability of technology to create computers that can compete with us in terms of not only knowledge but intuition and the ability to pass the Turing test, which is the idea that if you talk to a computer or a human for 20 minutes or so, if you can't tell the difference between the human and the computer, then that passes the Turing test. So, you know, if I say, hey, how are you doing? And the computer says, I am doing fine. You know, it's a computer. But if the computer says, hey, I'm doing good. How are you doing? What's up? How are your kids? How's Lucy? That kind of thing. Then you can have a machine that'll pass the Turing test. And we're coming up close to that right now. So, as I said, Liz will be back at the store October 28th, Friday, at 7 p.m. Hope you guys can all show up. And we got some really good books. This guy, Scott Stambach, who wrote this book, The Invisible Life of Ivan Issyenko, which is really, really weird. It's a perfect book for me. If you get into it, you're not sure if this is the kind of thing you want to read, read it, because it really is different. It's like this book. It's definitely different. And then the same is true of Patrick Flannery, who is going to be discussing his book, I Am No One, which is all these books are kind of out there. And then Ben Winters is going to discuss Underground Airlines, which is a really cool book. It's about an alternate future in which the Civil War never occurred. Abraham Lincoln was assassinated in 1859. There's still slaveries in four different states, which are called the Hard Four. And it's about, instead of an underground railroad, it's an underground airline. And the concept is that there are still people being ferried out from the hardcore back into the real world. But the real world isn't much different than the real world is right here, with the kind of police activity and citizen activity going both ways. So it's really not that much different. And especially given this election cycle and what's going on, I think it's very relevant, which is one of the things we talked about. So, as always, thank you so much for joining us. I really enjoyed this interview and the past few, and I'm looking forward to Rebecca finding some great new people. In fact, I think Liz's book, I think this one, The Unseen World, this summer and coming fall, I think it's really going to be a big book. So if you get a chance, like I said, come by and see her on October 28th, which is a Friday at 7 p.m. And thanks for being loyal listeners, and thanks for joining us here on The Avid Reader, and we hope you'll tune in again next week.